Extract number 1. Read the questions.
My castaway this week is the actor Matt Smith. Depending on your viewing preferences, he's either the best Time Lord there's ever been or as close to a young Prince Philip as humanly possible without actually being His Royal Highness. He's played plenty of different parts on stage and screen, but without doubt, the BBC smash hit Doctor Who and the hugely acclaimed Netflix series The Crown have to date provided him with his two defining roles, the significant critical success of both making him an international star. Yet if everything had gone to plan, he should by rights at the ripe old age of 35 be heading for retirement. He was going to be a footballer and had signed to Leicester City's youth team, but a devastating back problem put paid to a sporting career. He says, "There are great disciplines from being a sportsman that you can transfer into being an artist. The preparation, the sacrifice, the constant desire to improve." Welcome, Matt Smith.
Thank you for having me.
Interesting that, the preparation, the sacrifice. If I might add to that, maybe the spotlight, the adulation.
I would agree with you.
I'm interested in the degree of preparation you do. I mentioned there as Royal Highness Prince Philip in your portrayal of him in The Crown, which, you know, you weren't obvious casting for that. When I saw that you'd got the part, I thought, really?
Yeah, because I'm completely the wrong class, actually, for Prince Philip. But
you don't look like him, and then yet somehow you do. How did you do that physical thing?
Great wig. And, you know, you watch and you kind of pay attention to as much video footage and you read as much and you immerse yourself in the history and the context and the world of those people. For me, there's usually a physical thing, one physical thing and one vocal thing that I just repeat. And for him, he had his hands behind his back, so I would always walk with my hands behind my back. And then the other thing, which I've kept to this day, which makes Claire laugh, is I go, "Oh no, yes, absolutely. Oh no, absolutely, fine." Or I'd say, Olympic, because he says Olympic in a very sort of perfect way.
I saw a little snippet of a quote from you when you were talking about playing the part, and you said, "He's a cool cat."
He's a rock star.
You play him like that.
Well, thank you very much. And that's how I saw him, because he did what he wants, when he wants, how he wants. He didn't ask permission, and his wife was the queen. And in this day and age, in the current climate, with all the conversations that we're having about being a man and maleness and being a woman and, you know, what it is to be empowered as a woman and be respected as a woman, I just found that thrilling, really. And also, I kind of sided with him, which is controversial. Like, I kind of felt, yeah, I wouldn't really want to kneel to my wife.
We must, of course, talk about Doctor Who. I want to ask you about the next Doctor Who, the first female Doctor Who, Jodie Whittaker. It was, from some quarters, viewed as a very controversial decision. What was your reaction when you found out? Because I'm guessing you just found out the same time as the rest of us.
Yeah, well, no, actually. I phoned up my great friend, Piers Wenger, who's head of drama at the BBC. I pursued him for months about it. Tell me. And the day before, he said, OK, I'll tell you. And then it'd be nice if you rang her and, you know, said good luck and stuff. So he told me. And I think it's a brilliant choice, because I think that show, a bit like Shakespeare, actually sort of relies on big, broad, creative brushstrokes, you know. Anyway, so then I rang her, but she wasn't there. So I just sang the Doctor Who theme tune once, and I said nothing else, because I know the panic that sort of exists around keeping that secret. I kept it for like 5 months, and it was a nightmare. Yeah, and then she rang back, and she was like, "Oh man, who is this? I was like, "Jodie, well done."
And did you give her any little nuggets of advice, or did you say, "Be ready for this"?
The same as I gave Peter, which a director, a crazy Texan director, gave me after my first play at the Royal Court. And he looked at me and was like, "Hey, man, Matt, listen to no one." So that's what I pass on to people. You know, because it kind of has to be so idiosyncratic to you, and it's your blood and your bones, and I don't think it's something you can sort of pass on, that part.
Now, listen again.
My castaway this week is the actor Matt Smith. Depending on your viewing preferences, he's either the best Time Lord there's ever been or as close to a young Prince Philip as humanly possible without actually being His Royal Highness. He's played plenty of different parts on stage and screen, but without doubt, the BBC smash hit Doctor Who and the hugely acclaimed Netflix series The Crown have to date provided him with his two defining roles, the significant critical success of both making him an international star. Yet if everything had gone to plan, he should by rights at the ripe old age of 35 be heading for retirement. He was going to be a footballer and had signed to Leicester City's youth team, but a devastating back problem put paid to a sporting career. He says, "There are great disciplines from being a sportsman that you can transfer into being an artist. The preparation, the sacrifice, the constant desire to improve." Welcome, Matt Smith.
Thank you for having me.
Interesting that, the preparation, the sacrifice. If I might add to that, maybe the spotlight, the adulation.
I would agree with you.
I'm interested in the degree of preparation you do. I mentioned there as Royal Highness Prince Philip in your portrayal of him in The Crown, which, you know, you weren't obvious casting for that. When I saw that you'd got the part, I thought, really?
Yeah, because I'm completely the wrong class, actually, for Prince Philip. But
you don't look like him, and then yet somehow you do. How did you do that physical thing?
Great wig. And, you know, you watch and you kind of pay attention to as much video footage, and you read as much, and you immerse yourself in the history and the context and the world of those people. For me, there's usually a physical thing, one physical thing, and one vocal thing that I just repeat, repeat, repeat. And for him, he had his hands behind his back, so I would always walk with my hands behind my back. And then the other thing, which I've kept to this day, which makes Claire laugh, is I go, "Oh no, yes, absolutely. Oh no, 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 absolutely, fine." Or I'd say, "Olympic," because he says "Olympic" in a very sort of perfect way.
I saw a little snippet of a quote from you when you were talking about playing the part, and you said, "He's a cool cat.
He's a rock star.
You play him like that."
Well, thank you very much. And that's how I saw him, because he did what he wants, when he wants, how he wants. He didn't ask permission, and his wife was the queen. And in this day and age, in the current climate, with all the conversations that we're having about being a man and maleness and being a woman and, you know, what it is to be empowered as a woman and be respected as a woman, I just found that thrilling, really. And also, I kind of sided with him, which is controversial. Like, I kind of felt, yeah, I wouldn't really want to kneel to my wife.
We must, of course, talk about Doctor Who. I want to ask you about the next Doctor Who, the first female Doctor Who, Jodie Whittaker. It was, from some quarters, viewed as a very controversial decision. What was your reaction when you found out? Because I'm guessing you just found out at the same time as the rest of us.
Yeah, well, no, actually. I phoned up my great friend, Piers Wenger, who's head of drama at the BBC. I pursued him for months about it. Tell me, tell me, tell me. And the day before, he said, "Okay, I'll tell you, and then it'd be nice if you rang her and, you know, said good luck and stuff." So he told me, and I think it's a brilliant choice, because I think that show, a bit like Shakespeare, actually, sort of relies on big, broad, creative brushstrokes, you know? Anyway, so then I rang her, but she wasn't there, so I just sang the Doctor Who theme tune once, and I said nothing else, because I know the panic that sort of exists around keeping that secret. I kept it for like 5 months, and it was a nightmare. Yeah, and then she rang back, and she was like, "Oh man, who is this? Who is this?" I was like, "Jodie, well done."
And did you give her any little nuggets of advice, or did you say, "Be ready for this"?
The same as I gave Peter, which a director, a crazy Texan director, gave me after my first play at the Royal Court, and he looked at me and was like, "Hey man, Matt, listen to no one." So that's what I pass on to people. You know, because it kind of has to be so idiosyncratic to you, and it's your blood and your bones, and I don't think it's something you can sort of pass on, that part.
Extract number 2. Read the questions.
With the two special guests we've got, I think you will find it an inspiration tonight. Over to you, Val.
Thank you, Bill. So you see us sitting here as special, but we started off like you. We started off in ordinary towns in Scotland. My family were very much working class. My big start, I suppose, in life came because when I was 6, we moved house to live opposite Kirkcaldy Library, and the library became really my home from home. And I just read my way around the shelves of Kirkcaldy Library, and that was the first wee bit of a door opening of opportunity to me. I think what did it for me was I used to read these books called the Chalet School books, which are about a boarding school in Switzerland. I remember coming home to my parents one night and saying, "Why can I not go to a boarding school in Switzerland?" They just about fell off their chairs laughing. But one of the things that happened in these books is that over the years, characters grew up and went out into the world and had careers, and one of them became a writer. And then, and I remember one book, she got a letter from her publisher with a cheque in it, and that was the moment where I realised, oh my God, you get paid money for this. Mm. I can do that. I can tell lies. That was the point where I decided I wanted to be a writer. And I was lucky that I came from a household where I was encouraged to dream and to dream big.
But I've got a very similar kind of background. The town I grew up in is probably very similar to Kirkcaldy. Nobody in my family had gone to university. Mm. I probably was at secondary school, maybe even before I'd really met properly anybody that had been to university. Mm. And yet from a very young age, I knew that I wanted to be a lawyer. And I remember when I was at secondary school sort of trying to work out what I wanted to do and going to see the careers advisor that you went to see at the time and saying, I want to be a lawyer. And I remember vividly this woman saying to me, I don't think, you know, people from this school probably don't do things like that. And she suggested I should go and be a teacher instead, as if being a teacher was somehow less of a career than a lawyer. And the way I was, a bit like Val, maybe just a bit bloody-minded and sort of stubborn, I thought, well, I'm going to prove you wrong. I'm not going to accept that I can't do that.
Even when the odds are against you, you can turn things round. When I wanted to go to university, I decided I was going to go to Oxford University. I knew nothing about Oxford. I knew nothing much about England. And I went off and I found out what you had to do to get into Oxford, and I did the entrance exam. And then I went off to Oxford. I had interviews with the tutors in that particular subject, and then I had an interview with the principal. And she said, we've never taken anyone from a Scottish state school before. And because I was gallus and 16, I just said, well, it's about time you started. And I think that more than anything is what got me in. And she also said, we've never taken anyone as young as you before. What would you say if we said have a gap year and come back? You see, back in those days, gap years didn't really exist. And if I'd had a year out, I would just have spent a year working in the station hotel, waiting on tables. And I didn't really think that was going to prepare me very well for going to Oxford. So I just said, well, I'll go someplace else then. I mean, really, if you want something, don't be shy to go for it.
I remember when I went to Glasgow University to study law, my first few months at university were not the happiest time of my life. I went from a state school in the law school in Glasgow University, in my first year, I was surrounded by all of these young people who'd been to private schools in Glasgow. They seemed physically bigger than me. They were definitely posher than me. And they all just seemed so much more confident and cleverer than I was. And I spent the first few months thinking, I don't belong here. But I didn't want to give up, so I decided I was going to get to Christmas and then see how I felt then. And then when we got the results of the exams, it turned out I'd done as well as, if not actually better than, some of these privately educated people who were, kind of just being confident because that's how they'd been, you know, taught to be. It didn't mean they were cleverer. Give it your best shot and don't let any posh private school person put you off.
Yeah, I mean, for me, going to Oxford was a huge culture shock. Mm. I mean, the first thing was that they didn't understand what I was saying, okay? Because I come from Fife. Yeah, and I used to speak real...
Sorry, I don't understand
Fife.
That now either, Dad. Do you all
okay,
understand that?
We're just sitting here together, you're taking what I'm saying, eh?
Right, okay. Can somebody translate for me?
And this was, that was, I went off to Oxford speaking like that, Ken. And I went for my first tutorial and I started reading out my essay and my tutor stopped me and said, I'm terribly sorry, Miss McDermott, I really haven't understood a word you've said. Might we go back to the beginning again, and perhaps a little more slowly this time? So I realised that the first thing I had to do was learn to speak English, which is why I now have what my partner calls a BBC Radio 4 Scottish accent. But I was determined I wasn't going to be knocked back by something that I could change. Everything was different, you know, the food was different. You know, I mean, back in the 1960s in Scotland, we only had three vegetables, you know. They were always putting things in front of me. I didn't know if it was a table decoration or food. And it kind of came to a head one night, my first term, when we went to an Italian restaurant. And you'll find this hard to believe, but in the 1960s, early 70s, we didn't really have pasta in Fife. There were spaghetti hoops, but that was about it. And so I'm looking at this menu and I'm thinking, I don't know what any of these things are. And then I got to think, pizza. I said, I know what pizza is. So I ordered a pizza. And this round flat thing came with, you know, tomatoes and cheese and vegetables on the top. And I'm looking at it and I said, that's not pizza. And the waiter's going like, of course it's a pizza. What do you mean it's not a pizza? I said, of course it's not a pizza. He said, well, what's a pizza? I said, a pizza's half moon-shaped and covered in batter. Because that was all I'd ever seen in the pizza in the chip shop. But those are stumbling blocks. Those are just wee things. And you just grit your teeth and go like, well, that's another lesson learned. Mm-hmm. In England, they have funny pizzas.
Now, listen again.
With the two special guests we've got, I think you will find it an inspiration tonight. Over to you, Val.
Thank you, Bill. So you see us sitting here as special, but we started off like you. We started off in ordinary towns in Scotland. My family were very much working class. My big start, I suppose, in life came because when I was six, we moved house to live opposite Kirkcaldy Library. And the library became really my home from home. And I just read my way around the shelves of Kirkcaldy Library. And that was the first wee bit of a door opening of opportunity to me. I think what did it for me was I used to read these books called the Chalet School books, which are about a boarding school in Switzerland. I remember coming home to my parents one night and saying, why can I not go to a boarding school in Switzerland? They just about fell off their chairs laughing. But one of the things that happened in these books is that over the years, characters grew up and went out into the world and had careers, and one of them became a writer. And then, and I remember one book, she got a letter from her publisher with a cheque in it, and that was the moment where I realised, oh my God, you get paid money for this. I can do that. I can tell lies. That was the point where I decided I wanted to be a writer. And I was lucky that I came from a household where I was encouraged to dream and to dream big.
But I've got a very similar kind of background. The town I grew up in is probably very similar to Kirkcaldy. Nobody in my family had gone to university. I probably was at secondary school, maybe even before I'd really met properly anybody that had been to university. Yeah. And yet from a very young age, I knew that I wanted to be a lawyer. And I remember when I was at secondary school, sort of trying to work out what I wanted to do and going to see the careers advisor that you went to see at the time and saying, I want to be a lawyer. And I remember vividly this woman saying to me, I don't think, you know, people from this school probably don't do things like that. And she suggested I should go and be a teacher instead, as if being a teacher was somehow less of a career than a lawyer. And the way I was, a bit like Val, maybe just a bit bloody-minded and sort of stubborn, I thought, well, I'm going to prove you wrong. I'm not going to accept that I can't do that.
Even when the odds are against you, you can turn things round. When I wanted to go to university, I decided I was going to go to Oxford University. I knew nothing about Oxford. I knew nothing much about England. And I went off and I found out what you had to do to get into Oxford, and I did the entrance exam. And then I went off to Oxford. I had interviews with the tutors in that particular subject, and then I had an interview with the principal. And she said, we've never taken anyone from a Scottish state school before. And because I was gallus and 16, I just said, well, it's about time you started. And I think that more than anything is what got me in. As she also said, we've never taken anyone as young as you before. What would you say if we said, have a gap year and come back? You see, back in those days, gap years didn't really exist. And if I'd had a year out, I would just have spent a year working in the station hotel, waiting on tables. And I didn't really think that was going to prepare me very well for going to Oxford. So I just said, well, I'll go someplace else then. I mean, really, if you want something, don't be shy to go for it.
I remember when I went to Glasgow University to study law, my first few months at university were not the happiest time of my life. I went from a state school in the law school in Glasgow University. In my first year, I was surrounded by all of these young people who'd been to private schools in Glasgow. They seemed physically bigger than me. They were definitely posher than me. And they all just seemed so much more confident and cleverer than I was. And I spent the first few months thinking, I don't belong here. But I didn't want to give up. So I decided I was going to get to Christmas and then see how I felt then. And then when we got the results of the exams, it turned out I'd done as well as, if not actually better than, some of these privately educated people who were, can I just, being confident because that's how they'd been, you know, taught to be. It didn't mean they were cleverer. Give it your best shot and don't let any posh private school person put you off.
Yeah, I mean, for me, going to Oxford was a huge culture shock. I mean, the first thing was that they didn't understand what I was saying, okay? Because I come from Fife. Yeah, and I used to speak real...
Sorry, I don't understand that now either, Dad. Do you all understand that?
We're just sitting here together, you became what I'm saying, eh?
Right, okay. Can somebody translate for me?
And this was, that was, I went off to Oxford speaking like that, Ken. And I went for my first tutorial and I started reading out my essay and my tutor stopped me and said, I'm terribly sorry, Miss McDermott, I really haven't understood a word you've said. Might we go back to the beginning again, and perhaps a little more slowly this time? So I realised that the first thing I had to do was learn to speak English, which is why I now have what my partner calls a BBC Radio 4 Scottish accent. But I was determined I wasn't going to be knocked back by something that I could change. Everything was different, you know. The food was different. You know, I mean, back in the 1960s in Scotland, we only had three vegetables, you know. They were always putting things in front of me. I didn't know if it was a table decoration or food. And it came to a head one night, my first term, when we went to an Italian restaurant. And you'll find this hard to believe, but in the 1960s, early 70s, we didn't really have pasta in Fife. There were spaghetti hoops, but that was about it. And so I'm looking at this menu and I'm thinking, I don't know what any of these things are. And I got to think, pizza. I don't know what pizza is. So I ordered a pizza. And this round flat thing came with, you know, tomatoes and cheese and vegetables on the top. And I'm looking at it and I said, that's not pizza. And the waiter's going like, of course it's a pizza. What do you mean it's not a pizza? I said, of course it's not a pizza. He said, well, what's a pizza? I said, a pizza's half moon-shaped and covered in batter. Because that was all I'd ever seen in the pizza in the chip shop. But those are stumbling blocks. Those are just wee things. And you just grit your teeth and go like, well, that's another lesson learned. Mm-hmm. In England, they have funny pizzas.
That is the end of part one.